So I was told that we needed a speaker at last minute, and so this is a talk that I actually designed for somewhere else. And so if you want to interrupt me or take it in any direction you want, just please do so. I will go with that. And I chopped some slides and so on, but there's actually twice as many slides hidden away, so I can always go deeper on any topic. The slides I chopped were mostly technical ones, like numerical methods ones, because I kind of got the impression that was not the right thing for this audience. And so the ones I've kept are more physically oriented ones. So I come to galaxy formation, if this wants to change for me, there we go, from a slightly unusual perspective, which is I care whether the physics is correct. And this is a beautiful movie from the FIRE collaboration, and you can see that it looks wonderful. And that's one thing that that group is known for. I mean, I do think they do pretty good physics, so I'm not pretending that they don't. But the point is that this movie looking good is not any kind of direct measure of whether this is an accurate galaxy simulation. So what I like to do is look under the hood. And within the collaboration that Fra mentioned, that's kind of my role. I like fiddling with the physics and trying to convince myself whether it's correct or not. And so this means that I am at one end, and at the other end, we have people like Farah who actually say, you know, I want to model very specific galaxies with very specific scenarios and do the full cosmological context. So across the collaboration, we kind of touch sort of galaxies from different angles. And I think it's a good tension in the sense that Fra pushes me to actually simulate real galaxies, and I push the rest of the collaboration that I don't think the physics is being done right. And so that's a good tension. I think it's a healthy tension in our group. So we have a lot of things in our simulations. Many of them, you might hope that if you put in the PDE in some moderately good way, it will just work, and you don't need to think hard about that. So for our hydrodynamics, for example, we use an SPH method, and there was some controversy a few years ago about how correct this was. This is what our code looks like. This is Gadget 2 down in the bottom. So I think SPH has come a long way. I would not say that there's any issues with it as a method, and so I think a lot of this controversy has gone away, and hopefully now we can just focus more on the physics. And so if I go back to this slide, a lot of this we would hope we can just get by just doing the physics with some kind of direct modeling. And so the thing I like to focus on is the drivers for structure in galaxies. What is creating the structure? What is holding up the interstellar medium? What is maybe limiting star formation? Galaxies are very inefficient formers of stars compared to sort of naive expectations. So what is holding the galaxy up and preventing the whole thing from just collapsing? If you run a galaxy simulation with no feedback at all, it falls down and the whole thing becomes stars on a time scale of a few hundred mega years, right? So real galaxies don't do that. We need some churning to keep them inflated that is goes beyond just the most naive ideas. So one of the things that comes in a lot is AGN. So this is sort of cutting edge, I would say. This is a simulation from 2005. It's one of the first ones. It's Tiziano Di Matteo to put AGN in, and I'll just let that play. And on the right, we have some relatively recent work from Rosie Talbot and Debra Siaki. And this is a close-in zoom of an AGN. And so here we have the accretion torus. So way in the middle here, we have the accretion disk. And what's cute about this is the accretion disk is actually oriented 90 degrees from vertical. So the way this is done in simulations is typically, and you can see what's going on. This is state of the art from 2005. The AGN is destroying the galaxy disk. It is gone. Here we have state of the art closer to today. We have an AGN where the black hole accretion disk is oriented like this. The jets are oriented straight into the accretion torus, and yet nothing, right? So this is what resolution can do for you. If your resolution is too poor, your AGN will destroy your galaxy disk. If your resolution is high enough, as in this work, then just pure inertia, the mass in the accretion torus, is enough to force the jet to go straight up, even though it starts out pointing oriented in the plane of the disk, right? So this is the challenge with AGN. This is why I think it's a hard problem, because our resolution is not as bad as this, but it's not quite up to this yet. And so we're in a kind of a transition time where AGN remained hard. So this is why I personally have been kind of avoiding AGN as a topic. So the way I like to characterize galaxies is to think about different regions in temperature density phase space. So essentially we can resolve galaxies up to fairly high density. So down here we have density on the x-axis in a log scale. And this is 100 atoms per cc. At this point, you would expect the gas to become molecular, and you might hope to, from first principles, start to create star-forming regions and create stars in those regions. Here is the typical interstellar medium. The colors here indicate how much material is there. The vast majority of the material is actually sitting around 10,000 Kelvin, so-called warm ISM, and this is sort of well established. Here we're segueing into cosmology. This is the IGM, intergalactic medium, and here is a combination of sort of feedback and the circumgalactic medium. So that is another way of looking at galaxies, sort of what are the materials that make up galaxies? What states are they in? And a lot of work that's been done to date still reflects kind of old ideas about how to run galaxy simulations. So one way I like to do this is to break this space up and say, what is the physics that's going on in different parts of this space? So we have the hot collisional part, which is essentially the gas around galaxies, but this is the gas that has been through a galaxy, right? So it's either at least fallen in, it's gone through a virial shock, but a huge fraction of it has actually been through a galaxy and back out again. So it's experienced feedback. This is the only kind of pristine piece of this phase diagram, the intergalactic medium. You can see this slope here. This is actually a slope of constant entropy. This is material that all it's ever done since the start of the universe is expand, right? So this stuff is not even in equilibrium. It's primary. All it's really doing is just very, very slowly doing expansion cooling. It's the intergalactic medium between galaxies. Then we have cooler circumgalactic medium. So this is material that is coming from the hot medium back into galaxies. So there's structure here, a slightly cooler material. You can see this in absorption lines from quasars, for example. And then you can continue cooling. You join the regular interstellar medium, the disk of a galaxy. You continue cooling and you can form the molecular part of the disk of a galaxy where star formation should occur.
A question.
Sure.
Okay, so this picture, this seems kind of robust, but if you kind of turn up the resolution of the simulation, how
yes.
Does it change?
These parts I feel are very robust, as I'm kind of going to allude to. I think it's this transition that is very sensitive to the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, real galaxies don't really follow this curve. This curve kind of bottoms out around 100 Kelvin. Real galaxies go down to more like 10 Kelvin, and the sort of, this part here, the shape and the details, the sort of the mass balance between warm medium and cooler medium, that is quite sensitive to resolution. So historically, if you look at the first galaxy simulations, the resolution stopped here. So we actually called that the entire interstellar medium. We made stars from that. I think the very first work by Greg had a star formation threshold of 0.1 atoms per cc, because that's all we could get to. So we've been pushing into this regime over time as the resolution improved. Those early first simulations had resolution of order a million solar masses. So you had just huge chunks of the interstellar medium that you had to declare would form stars in some way. And I think the other thing about it is you could form a disk, but that disk would be fluffy. There was all sorts of issues. And we're gradually improving. But as we improve, we're needing more physics. So in the past, a lot of this physics was easy to do. The hot collisional part, adiabatic gas, sure.
Oh, sorry, I just wanted to know what the density in this density plot means. Is that like histogram of the number of gas particles?
So this is the mass fraction at that density and temperature.
Okay.
So the vast majority in the galaxy is sitting here in the ISM at 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So this is the classic ISM in textbooks kind of state. So where was I? So a lot of this is not so hard to do. I'm sort of refamiliarizing myself with this thing. So I have a few slides going on. The key thing is that these are sort of classic components. A lot of these names don't actually reflect physical states. They reflect what observers do to determine what's there, right? So the warm ionized medium is essentially observed through recombination lines primarily. So when observers see recombination lines, they say, aha, there must be an ionized medium recombining. Let's label that the warm ionized medium. We also have the warm neutral medium. Are they distinct phases? Do they occupy different regions of space? We don't actually know that because observers just see we have a warm neutral medium. We see that with 21 centimeter radio observations, we have a warm ionized medium. We see that with recombination lines. Are they distinct in space? These are questions that are actually hard to answer with observations directly. So these classes represent sort of observational distinction as opposed to sort of true states within a galaxy that we don't know. So in terms of what's doing the work to put stuff in different regions, in a moderately sized or smaller galaxy, this is all about inflow and outflow to galaxies. So initially, material falls into the galaxy, goes through the accretion shock, and you essentially ends up here. So this is the classic virial shock picture. We now know this is a simplification in the sense that galaxies are not spherical. So there's actually multiple ways to get in, and at higher redshift, you can actually reach almost all the way into the disk in a cool state. You can actually avoid the accretion shock. So this is more complicated than the classic picture now. But the other thing we know is you can churn stuff back into there, primarily through supernova and galactic winds. So we know we need this cycling. I'll come to sort of some details of why later. But essentially, you need to keep something like 3/4 of the baryons here. If you look at a galaxy and you say, where are the baryons? There are some in stars, about an equal amount in gas. And the vast majority are AWOL. And where are they? We think they're here. They're in the hot collisional medium around galaxies. They've been recycled. And so if you have supernova and do those well, you should be able to generate that phase. The other one is there should be nothing here. Many galaxy simulations have a lot of stuff here, but there should be nothing there. The cooling time is extremely short, so you should never have anything there. So this part is actually easy to do. If you have a cosmic UV background, then you get this part reasonably well. And I feel like the physics and the science of this and the matching to observations is all extremely good. So the IGM, I would say, is still of considerable interest because it probes the smallest scale structures in the universe that we know of. It's such an early state. We're talking over densities of 1 to 10. It's a direct probe of small-scale structure in the universe. It's interesting for that reason, but I also think there's no controversy coming there out of it in that sense. People like what they infer from that. It's completely consistent with Lambda CDM. So that's kind of a success of the past from my perspective.
Sorry, can I understand what you mean? So I mean, what is the observation that you say is kind of confirms the picture?
The Lyman Alpha Forest. So if you look at quasars and galaxies at higher redshifts, then there's this forest of absorption features, and the statistics of that is incredibly good. And so we can compare this to galaxy simulations, and the match is very, very good, right? So it's wonderful because it's a probe of this mildly nonlinear piece of the universe on very small scales.
But I mean, I want to push back on that because I'm missing that. I mean, the data is scarce. I mean, alpha forest is, I mean, you're forming a tiny fraction because it's just a neutral hydrogen, and there is a 5-sigma discrepancy with the standard cosmology, so depending on who you ask. But the point is that if you add enough knobs, and given that the data is scarce, you can fit anything. It's not clear to me just because the data is scarce on IGM.
I don't think the data is that scarce. I think, for example, the correlation function at that scale is fairly well understood. I agree with you, there are some rough edges, and that's going to be kind of what I'm going to come to. The key one, as you mentioned, is we only see the tiny neutral component.
Right, yeah.
The tiny neutral component depends on this UV background field. The vast majority of work assumes that background field is uniform. So if you have spatial variations, those spatial variations can change the neutral component. So yes, I agree that there's a... So I will step back. I will say qualitatively, the picture works. Quantitatively, yes, you could probably find
some. For a long time, we've talked about missing baryon problem, which I guess you.
I don't think there's a missing baryon problem here. I think there is in the other other states.
But you were saying something about, you know, some sort of five sigma.
Yeah.
What is this?
I think Kay Rogers had this paper recently. But I mean, it's been over the years there have been like a few kind of significant discrepancies with lamin alpha.
Do you know what this discrepancy is? I
mean, they just fit the spectrum and it just is inconsistent with. They need like large running or something. I don't know. So, but I mean, it could be some astrophysical thing. I'm not sure, but I think
also on very small scales you're talking about.
Yeah,
this is a big driver for warm dark matter ideas, right? So if you want to probe like a 1 keV sterile neutrino or something like that, this is the best probe for anything like that.
Sure, you know, but on scales that are like mildly nonlinear, like you were saying, right? So scales like k of like 0.1 or so or less.
Well, you see, there is no k here, right?
No, I understand, yeah. But you're talking about like a five sigma discrepancy as if this is like some huge problem for the IGM. But it sounds like really you're talking about extremely small scales that are highly nonlinear.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then I can imagine there might be modeling uncertainties and so on.
Right. But I mean, I think IGM, my point I'm making is that we don't really have that many ways of seeing IGM. And so saying that we are confident that we understand it, I think might be a bit premature.
I think we're confident that we understand it, but that doesn't mean that it's a tight enough measurement to rule out problems.
Yep.
So we have a story. We have a story that works. But there could be issues, sure. So here are the parts where I think radiation is important, and yes, even here, radiation fields could be important. So this part of this talk is to motivate the importance of radiation. And radiation, there's a lot going on. So in the IGM, then UV and X-ray backgrounds, galaxies locally dominate over the background, so they could completely change the neutral fractions. In the CGM, we have UV and X-ray backgrounds coming from the galaxy itself. So, for example, a lot of dwarf galaxies near the forming Milky Way probably get their star formation shut down because the Milky Way boosts the UV background locally. Then the interstellar medium. So the importance of different bands changes. So the primary heater of the interstellar medium is actually FUV. So the FUV-UV boundary is 13.6 eV. So when you can ionize hydrogen, obviously major component of the universe, you just don't get very far. Just below that, however, you can heat on dust grains. So the primary heater of the interstellar medium is actually 11-ish eV down to 6 eV photons hitting dust grains. So that's what actually heats galaxies and keeps stuff sort of between 5 and 10 K. And then going down into the molecular regime, then the EUV plays some role, but it's actually Lyman-Werner, so this is between about sort of 10 and 11 EV. This is radiation that can dissociate molecular hydrogen. And so there's a whole bunch of radiation, but also different bands that are important. So in terms of what I want to look at, I want to convince you that supernova and superbubbles are quite important and actually absent in many simulations. Farah has been helping me explore the impacts of this in some of her recent work. And the other one is gas phases as diagnostics. And I believe that just getting a good star formation rate is not sufficient to say your galaxies are okay. You should be able to match these phases individually. And I agree with you, you need to get quantitative matches, and I don't think we're quite there yet. So what do stars actually do? So this is the budget of stars. I extracted this with the help of Jasper Grund from Starburst 99. So I have put this in units of ergs per second per solar mass. So I have an average stellar population, including large stars, massive stars. They dominate the input, but they're a small fraction by number. And then you have a lot of little stars that don't actually do very much and mostly just dead weight. And those massive stars, for the first 3 or 4 million years, are doing everything. They're creating a huge luminous output. A lot of it is EUV, FUV. They create winds. The winds are actually driven by the same radiation. When they start to die at around 4 million years, they start to contribute supernovae. It's kind of interesting. The energy output, mechanical energy output of winds and supernovae is the same. Supernovae are mostly more important because on a log scale, they extend to about 40 megayears. So often when you hear about galaxy formation, it's all supernova feedback. But if you look at the actual budget numbers, the radiation output is enormous, right? So why are we ignoring this? Why have we been able to ignore this? And the answer is the scale. So the characteristic speeds of these can be thousands to 10,000 kilometers per second. So if you think on the scale of a whole galaxy where the escape velocity is 300 kilometers per second, you need these high speeds, high energy inputs to actually make a galaxy care, right? Radiation has a huge amount of energy, but all it does is ionize the gas. And when you ionize gas, you get it up to 10 to the 4 Kelvin, which has a characteristic speed of 10 kilometers per second. So there's a massive energy output, but it can't really do anything but churn up the interstellar medium. Very important on the scale of an individual cloud, very important within the central few hundred parsecs of a galaxy disk, but it cannot do anything on the scale of a whole galaxy. So this is an example of something that affects the states. And so if you want to get things right and really check all the boxes, then you do need this to get a proper interstellar medium and the right division between the different phases. But it's not going to control the baryon content of galaxies. This is unable to kick material out of galaxies. So this is why we focused first on the large scale. And another way of looking at it is that it's a natural division. The cooling rate here is enormous. Here's a cooling curve versus log temperature. There's a jump up of nearly three orders of magnitude at 10 to the 4K. So there's a natural division. You just can't have stuff between 10 to the 4K and 10 to the 5K. Nature just has a very short cooling time and just drags it all down. If you want stuff to persist, you have to put it above 10 to the 6K, and then the cooling times become long, or you have to just sort of sit down here and you've got this constant churn with the interstellar medium, all sources of energy. Now you may say, well, energy conservation has to go somewhere. Ultimately, it's reprocessed into optical and infrared and just leaves the galaxy without doing much else. So yes, huge inputs, but huge radiation outputs too. And so the net behavior is to sit here. So this is my basis for a sort of large scale, small scale division. And so superbubble feedback. So stars form in clusters, which is a good thing. This is a real star cluster in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And it has blown a bubble, which is currently a few hundred parsecs in size. So these are superbubbles. And it's actually the natural unit of feedback. A lot of early work on galaxies and even current work focuses on individual supernovae. But since stars are clustered, you're going to have at least 100 supernovae in one small region. And so we want to concentrate on the impact of 100 supernovae going off in a small region. There's some classic theory of this. This is actually going back to Weaver in the 70s. This was originally a wind model. And so you basically have a star cluster, and in classic physics style, we declare everything to be spherical. And so we consider this to be a point injection of energy at the middle. We can compute that. It's around 10 to the 34 ergs per second per solar mass. And then this is inflating a bubble. What's particularly cute, though, is that once you get to 10 to the 6 Kelvin or more, thermal conduction is quite strong. This is classic Spitzer conduction. Electrons have large mean free paths, and they can carry a significant amount of heat. What that does is attempting to conduct energy out of the bubble into the thin shell. However, what happens is that you get a mass flow in response because there's a slight pressure gradient causing material to flow off the interior surface. So the net effect is you actually heat the inner surface of the shell, and that material moves into the bubble, and you get no net mass, sorry, energy loss into the shell. Instead, all the energy that goes into the shell causes the inner layer to heat and join the bubble instead. So these are classic models going back to the 70s and 80s. So in this classic model, you actually keep 45% of your initial energy as heat. About 20% is kinetic energy of the expanding shell primarily. And you lose about 35% as radiative losses associated with the shell. Whereas individual supernovae, you actually lose about 90% of the energy. So the superbubble is qualitatively a different way to think about how feedback works. And thermal conduction is extremely temperature dependent. The amount of conduction goes as temperature to the seven halves. And so it is a very strong regulator and keeps the temperature of the bubble from exceeding about 10 to the 7 Kelvin. The initial temperature is of order 10 to the 10 Kelvin, right? So in the very early stages of supernova, it's crazy high. But you regulate, you drag mass into the bubble, and you increase the mass of the bubble until the temperature is kept around 10 to the 7 in later stages.
So, my question here.
Sure.
Kind of steady state model. So when you have
it's a self similar. So it's a Powell law self similar model.
Self similar, but you have continuously the supernovas exploding, right?
Yeah. So you have a steady energy injection for about 40 million years.
Okay, and then you see what happens afterwards, right?
So we actually, when we implemented it as a continuous injection model.
Right. But then when the injection stops, when this self-similar starts, after the injection stops or during?
No, it's during the whole period.
The whole period.
Yeah. There are self-similar models also for individual point injection events, point injection in time, the Seedorf-Taylor, for example. Yeah. So one thing that's different between a classic individual supernova like Seedorf-Taylor is that the shell is a lot thinner in this model, and also the Seedorf-Taylor has a different mass distribution over time. So this was initially implemented by my former student Ben Keller as his thesis work. And so we needed to add something that's missing in many codes. We had to add conduction. We had to deal with evaporation of the cold material into the hot material and so on. And so this is what you get. This is a Milky Way size galaxy. And the black points are star clusters, and the white color is 10 to the 7 Kelvin. So we are actually creating 10 to the 7 Kelvin gas in galaxy simulations, and you may think, well, that's no big deal. Surely that happens all the time. Until we did this, it was actually uncommon. Most people were not generating material this hot, and the reason they weren't is because I mentioned the resolution elements. They could be, say, 10 to the 5 solar masses. If you get a bunch of supernovae and inject it into 10 to the 5 solar masses, the average temperature you get is quite low. It's of order 100,000 Kelvin. And so part of making this work is we have to make sure that these bubbles are relatively low mass. So that was a slightly tricky aspect of this model.
Sorry, when the existence of these bubbles has been confirmed in data somehow?
Oh, yeah. There's some wonderful James Webb images showing these bubbles actually recently.
They confirm the properties that they are self-similar somehow.
There are some rough edges to this model. The main one is that they're not truly spherical. They probably contain some density variations, which lead to cooling and losses. So the real ones, there's some losses of order. Maybe 50% of the energy will be lost due to cooling. The classic self-similar solution, there is essentially no cooling losses within the bubble itself. But otherwise, everything matches up. So what's cute here is that you actually go straight from here to here in one go. So the bubbles that you create actually have densities of order 10 to the minus 2 and immediate temperatures of order 10 to the 7 Kelvin in one go. And so some of this material is not, in fact, in the area surrounding a galaxy. It's actually within the interstellar medium. So that's actually what you're creating spontaneously. And so that this diagram here shows what happens. In our model, things cool, they form stars. You immediately go here without actually leaving the interstellar medium, right? So you're starting at this point, and then you evolve adiabatically. So what that actually means is you're rising out of the interstellar medium. So this is a purely buoyant convective motion, right? So as you rise, you expand, and at constant entropy, you're on an adiabat, and your temperature goes down. So if you want to say, where is the stellar wind in this model? Here it is. You start here in the ISM, and you evolve along this line. And that is qualitatively different, because the vast majority of galaxies, like you may have heard of Illustris or some of those related groups, they create winds by blowing the stuff out. They give it 700 kilometers per second, and they just blow it out physically. In this model, things actually waft out. They start, and they just go up. The nice thing about that is they don't have to push their way through the medium aggressively. They can just kind of continuously rise at slow speed. Sure.
What does that mean for the mass loading
factor? A lot of the mass loading happens before they leave. So as they're kind of forming and as they go out, the mass loading, I think, is actually the hardest thing in any of these models to get right, because there's a lot of turbulence. So you can imagine as a bubble's trying to leave, it's got a shell that's sort of rubbing on the interstellar medium. You get a lot of turbulent layers at that interface. That interface drives mixing and increases the mass loading and then gives you your final result, right? So we have the classic minimal mass loading from those classic models from the 70s. On top of that, when it starts to rise, you should have Kelvin Helmholtz and Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities driving additional mixing. And that is incredibly hard to get right. I would say that is my biggest concern about this model. It's the resolution needed to get those detailed boundary layers could be nuts.
So you kind of anticipated my question, but I guess I was going to ask what prevents these bubbles from breaking up to smaller bubbles. I guess the other question follow up is that if you increase the resolution, how does the spectra change?
So they tend to reform, right? So if you boil water in a pot, it spontaneously makes bigger bubbles. They tend to, you know, and when something's rising convectively, they tend to form bigger bubbles out of any local smaller group of bubbles. But I agree with you, yes, the amount of mass loading and the amount of mixing, that's the biggest challenge. And one way to address that is very high resolution simulations of bubbles, and then to try and parameterize the amount of mixing and put that in by hand. We have a mixing model in our code. Does it need work? Yes, I think it does. It's something I currently have a student working on, actually. We can talk more about that later. So just for a comparison, what's out there in the literature? So here's one group. You can see a whole bunch of stuff here. It only gets to 10 to the 5 Kelvin. It's because they got all that supernova energy and they put it into a million solar masses. And similarly here, you get sort of strange stuff. So a lot of the work out there does okay. It gets galaxies that have the right overall properties like stellar mass content, but the interstellar medium and related material has all the wrong properties. And so this is partly what we're trying to do, is to fix that issue. This is going back to 2012. This is where I differ from some sort of colleagues in the area. I love this work. A lot of people were scared of this work. Cecilia Scannipieco did a nasty prank on the entire galaxy formation community. This was just at the time when abundance matching was first done. So before 2012, whenever you got a certain stellar mass in a galaxy, you would say, well, we don't know what halo that lives in really, in real galaxies. So it may be high or low, we don't know, it's okay. And so the whole community was quite happy to make lots and lots of stars. And 2013, the first papers came out showing abundance matching, making very good matches between stellar content and dark matter content. So at the time this comparison came out, the simulators did not know what the right answer was. They just naively did what they thought was right. here is stellar mass, halo mass. Here is the observations, which they did not know about. Here is all the gas becoming stars, and you can see the vast majority of the groups went up towards that. They did not know that they were supposed to be in this band. They put in what their physics intuition told them they should do, and they made bucket loads of stars. And I thought, great, that means the field is not over. There is actually work to do. That's my weird take on things, where a lot of people were horrified that their dirty laundry was out there flapping in the wind. And you might think, well, what does a failed galaxy look like? Crazy big bulges. So the rotation curves are nuts. Here's a normal rotation curve. These galaxies had crazy big bulges, so they were rotating at hundreds of kilometers per second at a few kiloparsecs. So that's what the failure looked like. We are here. Gas is us, gasoline. We had the same problem that everyone else did. A few smart people were ahead of the curve and realized that this issue was coming down the pipe. This is a Ramsey's model with AGN. As I alluded to earlier, I don't think AGN really blow up galaxies, but that's what they had it doing, and they managed to get out of jail free using that. And this is a very aggressive wind model that did the same thing. People were starting to realize there'd be a problem, so some of the groups threw in an extra model or two where they had essentially some kind of act of God to take the baryons out of the galaxy and save themselves. But otherwise, most people were failing. So we ran this on a cosmological galaxy or two. No feedback, everything becomes stars. Old feedback called blast wave, superbubble times two. Why do we do times two? Because everyone was doing it. The other kids are doing it, we're gonna do it too. Illustrious, for example, had times three on the supernova energy. There's a project called Nihao, which had a times 30. So people were realizing it was an issue that had to be solved, and they were sort of reaching and saying, maybe supernovae are more efficient than we thought, and maybe that's what solves the problem. You know, maybe the initial mass function of stars creates more massive stars, which creates more supernovae in the early universe, or, you know, wave your hands in whatever appropriate way, but put more energy in to give more feedback.
That's interesting. Sorry. So on the previous slide, where would the Milky Way be on this picture?
The Milky Way has about 3 by 10 to the 10. So the Milky Way, well, here you go, 10 to the 12. Yeah, the Milky Way should be here.
Okay, right. And so people knew even back then that the Milky Way stellar mass was around that and the halo moon.
Yeah, there was this kind of mass, you know, psychological fooling oneself, I feel. But as I said, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. It's like, this is cool. There's work to be done. There's things to be understood, right? But it shows you the scary aspect. So you're probably familiar with the idea of semi-analytic simulations, where you basically create many, many galaxies with pure prescriptions, right? And you have 63 parameters and you get what you get. I think what this is showing you is that galaxy formation has a lot of free parameters and people are using them. They're following their intuition. If their intuition is great, you get weird things that have no predictive power. So that's my main takeaway from this, is that we were losing predictive power in our simulations, right? You put us in a situation where you don't know what the answer is, and the answers were bad, right? So predictive power is what you would want. It's what you hope simulators and theorists give you, right? So the outcomes were wonderful. Here is the standard supernova energy. Here is times two. And there's the old stuff failing and making big bulges. So the rotation curve is good. And we have a lot of material with high angular momentum, which is what the other figure shows. And this isn't one galaxy. So it's got things happening. So a merger happened here and the star formation bumped up. So here is a sort of a mean trend. And this galaxy is doing its thing about that mean trend. And in the end, normal supernova energy was actually pretty good. Whereas double energy was actually overkill. So we were really happy. We actually got things to work without anything. No free parameters. We could even throw away a cheat case and just use the standard energy and get a pretty nice answer. We're of the opinion that we can absorb some problems. So if superbubbles have cooling losses, we can deal with that and we would still be in a reasonable place. So we have some wiggle room. So the way I interpret our model is we are a maximal model. Let's say that all the cooling issues with superbubbles are minimized. We give you an upper bound on what superbubbles can do. And we have some room to still get good answers, even if superbubbles have cooling losses.
But do you mean that you have no parameters? You still have to input how many superbubbles or like something like that?
So we take a standard initial mass function and get the number of massive stars from that and convert that to the number of supernovae. So we don't introduce new free parameters. On top of, so yes, there are unknowns, but we take standard numbers rather than inventing our own free parameters. So this model currently has no free parameters in that sense.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused. So on the previous slide, you said that, you had the slide where you said, maybe the one, yeah, this one. So here, it did work, right? Here you multiply the superbubble feedback you said by 2, 4, and so on, and it didn't quite work. So what was the difference between this case and the other one?
It's the same galaxy, same initial condition. No feedback, old feedback that gets you 10 to the 5 Kelvin. Superbubble gives you 10 to the 7 Kelvin. Superbubble with double supernova energy. Otherwise, the same galaxy.
And this gives you the right stellar to...
Yeah, so if you look at this figure, yes. It's the red line in this figure.
And you don't need to multiply by any fudge factor.
No fudge factors.
And here the gray band is measurements or?
Yes, this is the so-called abundance matching. Abundance matching is very cool. You basically look at the mass function of halos, which we know very well from the CMB, et cetera. And you look at the mass distribution of real galaxies and you just populate the halos and make it all match up. So that's abundance matching. And so that approach, I think, fully matured in 2013. So now we feel we have a pretty solid idea of what stellar mass lives in what halo. So most of this is happening in high redshift is the key. Even 10 to the 7 Kelvin is only 300 kilometers per second. It is actually not that fast in terms of getting out of a big halo, but progenitor Milky Ways, yes. So the kind of stuff that Ferrar does, dwarf galaxies, this kind of feedback really rips the gas out. And to be honest, if you go to high enough resolution, even the blast wave isn't too bad because you're not dealing with 10 to the 5 solar mass particles anymore when you crank them down to 1,000 solar mass particles. Any way of dumping the energy actually starts to look pretty good. It's all about early times, high redshifts. Dwarf galaxies lose baryons like crazy. And there's a lot of observational evidence to support that as well. So this is cute. We're in Waterloo. This is work by Mike Hudson and the CRHT lens group. This is using weak lensing to directly see the halo mass that goes with galaxy masses. So this is wonderful. Abundance matching is still statistical. This is direct. Direct observations on both axes. So stellar mass is observed. Stellar mass to halo mass observed. Things kind of go pretty well. You can see the regime that Frog works in, dwarf galaxies, the typical efficiency is low. So you get a peak efficiency around here, which is around the Milky Way. So most of the stars in the universe, the real engines that make those are Milky Ways, essentially, or Milky Way analogs at earlier redshifts. So things that are now dead ellipticals, at high redshift, they were Milky Way mass, churning out all the stars at that epoch. And as you go to lower and lower mass, the efficiency really drops. And as far as I can tell you, the exact shape of this curve here is somewhat controversial or hard to pin down. But the bottom line is that supernovae living in shallow potentials kick the baryons out and really limit star formation. And then at higher mass, you get a new phenomena. And I would argue that that phenomena is AGN. So when we run at high mass, we don't do very well because we don't have AGN. And this is exactly the point in halo mass where AGN starts to be substantial and could play a role. How that works, I think, is a wonderful piece of work for many, many careers of people to determine, but it's a hard problem. And we have collaborators working on this, many collaborators, actually, Mike Tremel and others, Jillian Bellavery and others. We've made a good start. We have some good results, but I think there's more work to be done there. So when we run our galaxies, we don't have AGN. So here is 10 to the 12 solar masses. We have failure at that point. So at that point, those galaxies start to build big bulges. If we had an AGN, that AGN would have a way of taking the material that's going towards that bulge and converting some of it into jets and energetic outflows that could quench that galaxy and prevent the bulge getting too big. However, we don't have that physics, so our galaxies failed and they swept up towards the all baryons in stars line. This is one reason why Farah is the perfect collaborator for me, because she's interested in this regime down to smaller objects, and I don't have to be so concerned that I don't have an AGN model. I don't know how I'm doing for time, anyway, so this is about the wafting outwards. So basically, you have feedback, it sends you here in phase space, and then you waft outwards. So here is 0.1 RVir and less, that's essentially the disk of the galaxy. And here's your outflow out to half the viral radius, puts you here, and then you have pristine gas. So this is essentially what's happening. You just basically pump the gas full of high entropy, and it goes out by itself. If you try and do it purely ballistically with the wind, it's really hard. There's a lot of column between you in the intergalactic space, right? You have to force your way through that. However, if you give stuff high entropy, it'll just get there on its own, with some mixing, possibly, on the way. So the key thing is providing buoyancy. We can get out there slowly. And this was a nice result from a paper Ben wrote a couple of years ago, where we actually find that the observations are slow speeds of order 100 kilometers per second. They are not close up to the virial velocity or the escape velocity of a galaxy. So if you look at the material in the clouds within the halo of a galaxy and ask how fast is that material moving, is it moving at a speed consistent with high-speed winds? The answer is no. All right, so we feel that this model where things rise slowly is more consistent with observations.
Far out then does this buoyant gas get?
This is hard to know because all the observations are spectra, so all we have is velocity offsets.
Simulations, let's say, like, so how far out does it get? Does it approach the virial radius or beyond?
Roughly at the virial radius. See, for us, we don't particularly care whether it truly escapes or whether it just sort of bobbles around the virial radius for 10 gigayears. It's kind of the same from the perspective of keeping the baryons out of the disk and stopping them forming stars.
But if we see enriched gas, you know, say like, you know, far beyond the virial radius of galaxies in the MGM,
you would probably need a more violent form of feedback than we typically do. Yeah.
What does that seem? I actually don't know.
Well, there are dwarf galaxies everywhere, is the thing. So space is filled with dwarf galaxies. So if you just focus on big L-star galaxies, it might seem surprising, but dwarf galaxies fill space, more or less. So you're going to see enriched material all over the place.
So that, there were this work with, the name escapes me, but about these light membrane galaxies that bloom in out like a megaparsec away.
Yeah, so they're Milky Way analogs at high redshift. Yeah.
At like redshift 3. So that does escape, presumably, doesn't it?
Well, if you have a high enough star formation rate, the wind speeds do get larger, right? If you can essentially make a hole in the circumgalactic medium, yes, you could push stuff out quite fast.
Yeah, but you think, at least in your simulations, they don't get out.
So these are intermediate redshift observations by Jessica Work. I can't remember the exact details, but yes. So we do see reasonably high speed winds, but we also see low speed ones, whereas most of the other models, high speed winds is the only mode.
Yeah,
available.
Chuck Steidel's work, I think.
Yes, Steidel and company.
There are metallicity, like you said, metallicity up to, I don't know, a good fraction of megaparsec out of this light membrane galaxy. That's my recollection. But that was at redshift of 3.
Yeah.
And then this is at what redshift it is?
I think it's redshifts 2 to 4. I think it's 2 to 4.
2 to 4, okay.
Mm-hmm. So that's my overview for superbubbles and supernovae. I want to do a quick note on the other stuff we're doing. So we are now putting in radiation. This is a new angle, and the whole point of putting in radiation is to get all the details right from the IgM all the way through to the cold molecular gas. So we're including FUV, which is photoelectric heating on dust grains. We include Lyman-Werner, which dissociates H2. It's very complicated. Porik knows how complicated it is, my student Porik. And that is because they are bands composed of really fine lines, not nice, clean absorption. We have EUV and X-rays, extremely high opacities. It doesn't get very far. And we have bands that can do extra things like ionize H2 or ionize helium. So we have a lot of bands to consider. And the other thing is that the coronal gas, the hot gas around the galaxy, is constantly recombining and producing UV and X-rays. So that there's a lot of sources all over the place for this stuff, and we wanted to be able to model that. And so what we came up with was what we call a narrow band approximation. And the idea is that we actually do radiative transfer at several points in space, and we put 2 points on either side of these jumps. So the idea is that on the left of this jump, the opacity is relatively low, and then on the right of this jump, we're in the hydrogen absorption regime, and the opacity is very high. And so we want to be able to handle essentially discontinuities in our effective spectra. So that's what we want to do. So as you evolve a star cluster, you can see that these jumps become more and more pronounced. And so the red line is our approximation. We're trying to model these evolving spectra as these stars age. And so it's a piecewise power law. And we have a paper that it's a preprint now. We're dealing with a referee who is Nick Nedden, who's very grumpy. hopefully we'll get the final revision out soon. So this is an example. Sorry?
No, the previous plot. So the black line is the result of simulation.
The black line is a composite emission spectrum from a star cluster.
So it's measured.
Wow, measured actually, and then modeled and then put together. So yes, it's the degree to which you believe stellar atmospheres model is, but a pretty good match to a real star cluster, I would say. And this is the Hart-Madow background, and this is our fit to it. So this is essentially the background, starts at very high redshift. Around redshift 6, you reionize the universe. And then you have a combination of quasars and smaller galaxies who are the primary sources. The quasars contribute a lot here at very high photon energies. And then this radiation background just passes through the entire universe and gets reprocessed. And so Hart and Madow, starting in 96, and they did an update in 2012, calculated this whole reprocessing. So this is some generic averaged radiation field across essentially the age of the universe, and here we have these special frequencies where things happen. So their ionization jumps. And so we can put that in too. And when we get combined spectra, when we do our own absorption, we get very extreme variations in the net spectrum that you see at any point in space. And this is a somewhat of a silly plot, but it's preliminary, so I hope you'll let me get away with it. So we're doing radio transfer. We want to be able to handle all these things. The way we're doing it is ray tracing. This is a way of actually doing this in real time. Radio transfer is typically really slow because it turns out that light travels really fast. We discovered this. And it means that the time step it requires is very, very short. So most things in the universe move at up to 1,000 kilometers per second. Light goes at 300,000 kilometers per second. It wants time steps 300 times smaller than anything else in your simulation. We already run for a month. We don't want to have to run for 300 months. And so we need an approximation that that can handle this. And we're using ray tracing, which means we effectively ignore the speed and just trace from source to absorber in one go. And that's what we're doing. And I had a lot of technical slides on this that I have removed. The other thing we do that is very novel is we actually put in the background. So most simulations focus on reionization. They get a large box and they try and focus on how the universe gets reionized. We care about individual galaxies. Those reionization simulations have atrocious resolution. They can't model individual galaxies. So we actually put the average background at a separation of several megaparsecs from our zoomed in galaxies and then model all the sources and sinks within that zoomed in region. So we're not doing representative volumes of the universe. We're doing zooms in on individual galaxies with a background imposed from a shell. So this is how we model the shell. We basically put a sphere of sources around our galaxy, and then it radiates inwards to provide the background, and it gets reprocessed by whatever material's in the way. So this is some very preliminary stuff. Here's some galaxies that I've run with another collaborator, Siqing Shen and her group. So we have just superbubble, and we have superbubble plus radio transfer. And what we're finding it's doing is it's actually shutting down the star formation in the small galaxies. So the first galaxy to get going is the one that will ultimately be the larger one in the group. It starts spitting out lots of radiation, and that can suppress and heat the interstellar medium in the companions. So galaxies that actually form stars, such as this one here in the superbubble feedback only version, didn't form stars in the radio transfer version. So this is sort of, there are some rough edges on the radio transfer that we're trying to convince ourselves that the biggest problem is that the absorption by hydrogen is so phenomenally large that we want to be sure that we've converged, for example. So here is another one showing an individual galaxy. It's popping away and doing its thing. So the focus here is on the star formation history. And when we had supernovae only, as you might imagine, it's very bursty. The gas comes in, you form a star cluster, it can blow up the whole dwarf. And so the star formation essentially has a lot of, you can see a lot of variation in the H1 content in the galaxy, for example, with just a superbubble. But when we go to the rate of transfer, the amount of neutral gas is fairly steady. And the amount of star formation is much steadier as well. So it seems like it's a lot less bursty than we were getting before. So with the caveat, this is preliminary, that seems to be what's starting to come out.
How does this compare to what the Edge group is saying with their RT?
I haven't done a direct comparison, so I couldn't tell you.
So can I ask, so is the main effect of this radiation, radiative transfer for inclusion, I mean, is it just the dust absorption,
So each band is absorbed differently. The FUV is onto dust. The dust mostly re-radiates in the infrared. So once stuff's gone through dust, it's kind of removed from the system for the most part. So mostly dust is just an absorber, but the remaining material, it's the ionization and heating of the gas that we're focusing on. So for the higher energy bands, it's ionizing the hydrogen, destroying the molecular hydrogen, these kinds of roles. And the phase diagram also looks a little bit different. And so with the superbubble, for example, we get a lot more burstiness, whereas with the rate of transfer, we get a more consistent, cooler phase that is more persistent. So that's probably a good spot to stop. So we have a reverse ray tracing code, which is fast, that is able to run simulations at comparable speed to our prior cosmological galaxy simulations. And we want to get a detailed spectrum, partly because the observables are mostly metal lines. So we want to have a detailed spectrum so we know the state of the metals. And then we can compare to observations from quasars, absorption lines, etc. So that is partly our motivation to have a detailed spectrum. And Farrar and I are busy hiring students and think looking ahead to how we can kind of exploit this. And kind of that's where we are right now.
Thanks.
Questions?
Maybe I can ask one last question. So why is AGN so hard?
Do it yourself then.
But you've done all this other hard work, so why is AGN harder than
that? It goes back to your question about resolution and so on. It seems at low resolution, you do this. You blow up the galaxy. Whereas at high resolution, you don't. The accretion torus doesn't even care that the AGN is there. So you can see that this sort of, we're edge on here. This is the accretion torus. There is a black hole attempting to send a jet straight into it. And just the inertia of the torus is enough to force the jet to turn around and go vertical. Right, so it turns out that blowing holes in galaxies with AGN does not seem to be something that occurs in nature, but it's just what happens when you run at lower resolution. So the resolution that these guys used here was insane, and they only ran, I think, for a million years or something, right? So you cannot use that resolution in a galaxy simulation.
So
we can learn from this, hopefully, and then work out how to do it right.
So none of the simulations, at least on larger scales, you don't think any of them have jets right, basically? No.
Well, they do it, but they often do. So Deborah Siaki's done a lot of work on cosmological scales as well, and they often do it with free parameters. So they say, I have a jet. The jet goes a certain distance. I will have the energy appear 100 kiloparsecs away from the black hole. And then I can avoid all these issues of pushing through, you know. But then you have many, many free parameters, and you can kind of... I think there's a natural human tendency to stop playing with the free parameters when the answer looks good. Right, and so that leaves us in places which I think don't necessarily have predictive power. They give us indications as to one way to get to the answer, but they don't, since they're not first principles, they don't have that kind of predictive, that's the way nature gets to that answer. So we have a lot of ideas about how to do it, but they involve a lot of free parameters. Illustris has something like 60 plus free parameters. There's a whole table of them in their papers.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Just one more before we eat.
Well, so you mentioned how, you know, including this UV feedback makes the star formation much less bursty.
Smoother, yes.
Yeah. Like, so in dwarfs, is that a problem, actually? You know, because I thought...
Well, it seems to be able to shut them down. It seems to be able to shut them down. So when it is allowed to occur, it seems to be smoother. And again, so with the caveat that was preliminary, we're not 100% that it's the final form. We kind of want it. Like if you want to do the cusp core stuff,
exactly,
you want the burstiness. So that's why I'm putting lots of caveats on it. I want to be sure it's really what should happen.
So I just got HST funding all my old works with radiative transfer turned on. So we have blast wave, we have superbubble, and then we want superbubble plus radiative transfer. So
you might bring the cut. I mean, you might bring this core cusp problem back. You're saying?
I hope not.
I think part of it's this long tail. So the supernova kind of come and go, but the FUV has this sort of broader thing. So it's longer range, so you can regulate things sort of globally using UV in a way you can't.
Strong feedback as we get terrible ISM.
So
yeah, that's the trouble.
If you want and still preserve feedback as a solution to the cluster core problem, that's really hard.
So if you want to talk about tensions, getting the cellular mass to halo mass right, you can do that with aggressive feedback, but then your ISM is wrecked.
Yeah, your ISM is terrible. So if you wanted me to do a detailed study of it, I wouldn't want to.
No, just understand. So in these simulations, the dark matter profile is still cluster, right?
Not necessarily. So if the sublimation is bursty, you can make a core.
And that's still a free norm in your model.
Well, the dark matter just does what it does. So the core formation is completely physically driven.
The super bubbles still end up turning cusps into cores.
Mm-hmm.
The efficiency and the peak stellar to halo mass at which it happens changes slightly. So I just put a paper on archive in December about this with my students. The question is if the further smoothing of the burstiness that happens with radiative transfer will erase that transition to feedback because it smooths out the star formation histories. So the idea is we might have just bit ourselves.
Yeah. Got ourselves in the foot on that.
Yeah, there we go. I'm really bad at phrases.
Yeah.
And so that's the next question that James and his student, or former student Ben and I are looking at.
Are we getting some kind of outflows in dark matter, due to this, or actually it's the other way around?
The dark matter, the energy contribution to dark matter from burstiness is very much concentrated in the central kiloparsec. So in terms of perturbing the halo structure beyond that, you see almost no change at all.
I see. Despite the fact that there are all these bubbles coming from the disk, the halo remains.
It's all about whether it's adiabatic or impulsive from the perspective of the dark matter. And only the central burstiness is sufficiently impulsive to give energy to the dark matter. We don't see much transfer in the larger halo. The bubbles are very slow moving. They don't really transfer energy. The dark matter is overwhelmingly adiabatic and just shrugs off whatever the gas is doing most of the time.
But the central region is very much affected, right? So the central.
The observations are not 100% conclusive on cores, but yes, I personally think cores look. Yeah, 90%, like they really are there and we need to worry about them and make them. And most of our evidence is from dwarf galaxies, specifically dwarf galaxies in the local group.
So when you said the ISM gets terrible in what sense?
It's too, we can't make like a cold phase at all when you have such such strong feedback.
And also scale heights, they really inflate. Like real galaxies have a lot of mass within 100 parsecs. And these can, like some of the fire galaxies have scale heights of order 2 kiloparsecs.
Shapes of dwarf galaxies. Yeah. So fire has a very, very, very strong feedback model. They're not varies for it. And so they can't create the full range of galaxy dwarf shapes. All of their things are these spherical fluff.
They're very, very fluffy, puffed up.
So
some of my collaborators would like us to use 10% of the supernova energy. The ones that focus on ISM structure and so on. They hate the full budget. They want it way suppressed.
In the interest of my rumbly belly, we can continue over lunch in the bistro.
All right, thanks again.